Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientists, the 8th of August 2018, episode 1. In my cardiac rehab, I've tried to do a few podcasts today, fell asleep during the day. It's a real effort. I'm going to try and get up to 40 minutes just reading through this New Scientist. Now the first article is not by an author, it's an editorial comment at the start. Send in the climate change lawyers byline, legal action is a legitimate tool to compel government action. The coalition of climate action is nothing if not broad. Civil society pushes grassroots actions and civil rights groups make the humanitarian arguments. Economists, financial institutions and big companies increasingly press for economic case for action, rightly seeing in global warming the threat to the world's prosperity. Even the Pope and the Pentagon have waded in. So far, however, the responses of government to curb emissions have been half-hearted at best. Now the inaction faces a stern test in the courts. Legal action on climate change is not new. In 2007, Massachusetts versus EPA, the US Supreme Court ruled on behalf of 12 states and several cities that the Environmental Protection Agency was obliged by law to regulate the emission of CO2 from cars. For a long time, this was an isolated success, but recent years have arisen of strategic lawsuits, one that could have wide-ranging impacts by setting a precedent or triggering policy changes. The cases largely involve people taking on governments for their failure to legislate to protect them against climate change, or people directly targeting fossil fuel companies demanding either compensation or harm done or money to shield them from future damages. Most suits are in the US, and more than a dozen directly challenge the Trump administration's actions to deregulate emissions. Some people, including judges presiding over climate cases, have questioned whether the courts are the right place for climate policy to be determined. To be sure, no one wants government to by judicial fate. But in democratic society, the law exists because someone has made it, and it is right for every citizen to seek protection. When all else fails, send in the lawyers. The right to be natural, the second article here. It is tempting to think people who entrust their family planning to an app that uses bodily temperatures to work out when they're fertile deserve all they have coming. Certainly the app, Natural Cycles, recently approved as a form of contraception in the European Union and US, has been controversial, especially after it is linked to several abortions in Sweden last year. Women may fail to heed the app's warnings on fertile days, or the app itself may sometimes get it wrong, but all contraceptive methods fail. Pills get forgotten, injections are missed, condoms skipped. The average effectiveness of most contraceptive methods is usually considerably lower than the perfect use effectiveness. What's clear is that Natural Cycles works pretty well for at least some women. Hormonal contraception is still likely to be best option for many, but those who have had side effects who balk at chemically altering their bodies have a right to seek alternatives. Abortion is a separate issue. It should not be used to generate moral panic over a genuine advance of free choice. 3 minutes in. Gosh, I've got a lot to read into. Okay, now this article is by Chelsea White. A glimpse of a previous universe this week. Can we see black holes from before the Big Bang? Asks Chelsea White. Swirly patterns in the sky may be signs of black holes that survived the destruction of the universe before the Big Bang. That's an interesting aspect of it. That's wishful thinking. Quote, what we claim we're seeing is the final remnant after a black hole has evaporated away in a previous eon, says Roger Penrose, a mathematical physicist at the University of Oxford. Oh, God, he's still active. I can't believe it. He's the co-creator of a theory called Conformal Cyclic Cosmology, CCC. It states that rather than having started as the Big Bang, the universe infinitely cycles through periods of ballooning up and compressing back to a tiny point. This could let electromagnetic radiation pass unscathed from one aeon to the next. And Penrose and his colleagues see the remnants of cosmic microwave background, the faint radiation that fills the universe. Oh, God. They have named these spots in the sky Hawking points after Stephen Hawking's. Hawking predicted that black holes should emit small amounts of electromagnetic radiation. We have never seen this Hawking radiation, but we should think black holes, it should shrink black holes until they evaporate. Penrose is saying that we may be able to see signs of Hawking radiation left over from previous universe. Quote, I think he would have been delighted to see actual effect he predicted in observation, says Penrose. These Hawking points pop up in the map created by BICEP 2, a radio telescope at the South Pole, says Penrose, says Penrose's colleagues. In 2014, BICEP 2 found distinctive swirls of polarized light in the microwave background. Okay. And the BICEP 2 team said these swirls, known as B-modes, were caused by gravitational waves from inflation, the universe's growth spurt after the Big Bang. Data from the Planck spacecraft later showed that the B-modes were probably created by interstellar dust, but Penrose and his colleagues have another explanation. They noticed a point in the BICEP 2 map surrounded by a ring of polarized light, indicating a vast temperature difference between the inner and outer part. They suggest these are magnetic fields from the black holes in the previous eon and have spewed into the Hawking radiation. Oh well, okay. According to CCC, all the energy of evaporating black hole would be compressed into one tiny point as the universe shrank before expanding again in a new eon. We don't see the Hawking points themselves in the data, Penrose says, because this cosmic microwave background, which only goes back to 380,000 years after the Big Bang. But we do see rings. Penrose and his colleagues saw 20 of these areas of temperature in the BICEP maps. So far, they think that one of those is the Hawking points. But Penrose says simulations show 4 or 5 more that warrant investigation. Oh, God. Other effects could mimic this signal, says Oliver Dorr at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. Quote, I love the fact that their cosmological model predicts specific signatures in the data. Quote, he says, but I'd need to see more details to be convinced by their claim, as it would certainly be very interesting. Typical New Scientist article. Black hole down. Brian Keating at the University of California, San Diego, a member of the BICEP 2 team, says B mode spot in question is likely to be due to the bending of light by massive objects in space. Quote, they're not interpreting our results the way that we do, he says, but photons don't come with a sign that says, I came from a black hole, or I came from a dust grain. The bigger the problem is that BICEP 2 team hasn't realized it's released its raw data. The Penrose team is working from images. Each pixel averages data over a very wide swath of the cosmos. So it is difficult to make claims about a single point, says Keating. Penrose and his team used maps of the cosmic microwave background from the Planck Space Telescope to check that the points weren't a fluke of the BICEP 2 map. They also ran 4,000 simulations of a developing universe and found that these anomalous points still arise. Quote, that means there is probably caused not by chance, but some physical phenomena, says Daniel at Sunny Maritime College at New York, one of Penrose's colleagues. Now, CCC predicts the signals they see, perhaps the theory is correct, he says. Oh, gosh, that's really pushing it. Okay, now who's Noah's author for this one? Mission to the Sun begins. NASA's Parker Space Solar Probe is on its way to the Sun spacecraft, which is designed to enter and study the Sun's scorching atmosphere, launch, because we're all in the atmosphere, launch from Cape Canaveral in Florida at 3:31 a.m. local time, after a failed attempt on the previous day. The probe equipped with carbon heat shields protected from the Sun's atmosphere. I really wonder whether it's isotropic carbon, the corona where the temperatures can reach a few million degrees Celsius. The mission team is hoping for a close look at the corona and will solve the ongoing mysteries such as why it's 300 times hotter than the surface of a star. They want to study coronal mass ejections, outbursts of solar particles that can disrupt the Earth's magnetic field and interfere with satellites and power grids. Shooting the probe directly towards the Sun would require tremendous energy, about 55 times more than it takes to get to Mars. Instead, the probe is taking a detour on Venus. So it's more energy to lose the angular momentum, I suppose. Yeah, okay. The planet's gravity will help whip the spacecraft into orbit. So instead, the probe is taking a detour to Venus, where it will arrive on the 2nd of October. The planet's gravity will help whip the spacecraft into an orbit that gets closer to the Sun. The probe will dip in the corona for the first time in November. In a total, it will make 24 loops around the Sun during a 7-year mission. And will come 6.2 million kilometres of the star's surface. Now, the Sun is 1.3 million around, so it's 10% within a factor of 10. Spark a telescope, and we're 400 times away, so it's not that incredibly close. Spark a space solar probe will also break the record for the fastest artificial object, reaching speeds as high as 700,000 kilometres per hour, which per second it would be faster than the speed of light as it approaches the Sun. So it's still, well, under a thousandth the speed of light. New Zealand's latest to ban plastic bags, single-use shopping bags, will be banned in New Zealand next year. The country's government last week. The retailer will be given 6 months to phase out the bags and the face fines up to $1,000. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern told a press conference that plastic pollution was the subject school children wrote to her most about. Of course, most of the plastic comes from China and from Philippines. New Zealand currently uses more than 75 million single-use paper bags per year, which is equivalent to about 150 per person. The mountain of bags, many of which end up polluting the precious coastal and marine environments, can cause serious harm to all kinds of marine life, said Ardern. Bangladesh was the first country to ban thin plastic bags in 2002, with China and the Netherlands and some other countries implementing single bans since then. Well then why is all the pollution there? UK has 5p charge for plastic bags to deter use. Some Australian supermarkets have voluntarily stopped handing out free single-use bags this month. Malware risk from new article. Malware risk from Fortnite fans. Fortnite seems to be a game, spelled Fortnite. The video game mega hit Fortnite is finally coming to Android, a move that prompted warnings from security researchers. Almost all apps for Android phones and tablets are distributed via Google Play Store, giving Google a 30% cut of any money made by the app. To get around this, Epic Games, the maker of Fortnite, is not putting it on Google Play. Instead, it's on asking Android players to download the game directly from its website. But to do this, users have to first disable security settings that normally prevents installation of third-party apps, protecting them from malware. While it is possible to enable the setting again afterwards, some devices do this already, some users may forget. And there's risks that keen gamers will be tricked into downloading a completely different. Before Fortnite for Android had even been officially launched, dozens of sites began offering bogus download links. Well, there you go. I find Google really, really sneaky and uncaring. That's just my own thought as a programmer out here. You have to use it, but oh god. AI now as good as best I doctors. DeepMind's artificial intelligence can spot key signs of eye disease as well as the world's top consultants. Anonymous diagnostic data from almost 15,000 patients in the UK National Health Service was used to help an AI system learn how to spot 10 key features of eye disease. The AI analysis complex optical coherence tomography retinal scans. And that would be interesting. What's that one? I'll have to research that, see if I can remember that. So difficult, this is memory. So see if I can get that into my head. Complex optical coherence tomography, OCT, retinal scans, which generate 3D image of the back of the eye, revealing abnormalities. Now that is really interesting. I wonder how that's done. The system was developed by scientists at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London and University College of London. It's assessed patients more than 50 eye conditions correctly before in more than 94% of cases, matching the performance of leading doctors from around the world. AI doesn't make a diagnosis, but recommends which patients should be seen urgently by a specialist, or simply placed under observation. And the team hopes it could be rolled out across hospitals within the UK. So, complex optical coherence tomography. What I actually do think is that you can get a distance measure by the coherence of a pulse coming back. If you send a laser pulse out, which is incoherent, you can measure the coherence distance. I did that with optical fibers. I don't know how that works. So see if I can remember that. By Claire Wilson, using technology, Blain glue hold memories longer. We can't, by Claire Wilson, this is really 15 minutes in, I've got a long way to go. Can we bond brain cells together to protect our memories from aging of Alzheimer's? It's an eccentric idea, but there are signs it could work. Rahul Kushnick of the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases at Marburg and his colleagues have created a molecule to reinforce the connections between the brain cells called neurons, acting like steel bars in reinforced concrete. Although the approach hasn't been tested in people, injecting the molecule into the brains of mice seem to improve their memories. It's very clever and has a natural logic to it, says John Ackleton of Cardiff University, UK. Connections between brain cells, known as synapses, allow signals to jump from one to another. Our memories are made of a network of strengthening synapses between millions of brain cells distributed in our head. To reinforce this, Kushnick's team has designed a molecule called CPTX. The chemical binds to compounds on the surface of the brain cells on either side of the synapse, creating an artificial bridge between the two cells. Wow. In Alzheimer's disease, people gradually use synapses for decades before the damage is enough to start causing memory loss and confusion. Quote, the idea is you don't allow the synapses to go away. We don't let two neurons detach from one another completely. I'm sure this is bad. When the team injected the molecule into mice genetically altered to have Alzheimer's-like symptoms, they did better in memory tests than the same kind of mice that didn't receive the chemical. These tests included having to recognize a new object and learning that they would receive electric shock at a certain location. Oh, thanks. When the animals' brains were examined, those that received the treatment with 30% more synapses than those who didn't. Kush told the Federation of European Neuroscientist Societies meeting at Berlin last month. The effect tailed off after 7 days, but the team is developing a gene therapy in the hope that it will make the brain cells produce their own supply of synapse-boosting molecule. Quote, you could have long-lasting effects up to years. Carol Rutledge of the charity Alzheimer's Research UK says that if the technique works, we would also need to better test to detect the onset of dementia several years before the symptoms begin. Quote, lots of people are focusing on early diagnosis. Everyone realizes we need to treat earlier than we're doing. Rutledge says the approach might also help people who develop memory problems in common with aging. That's probably me. Whether we should be able to slow down the cognitive aging, that's a whole other question, she says. A big unknown, though, is whether the artificial synapse center might make it harder to forget things that we normally want to lose, such as day-to-day trivia. Ankleton says people shouldn't get too optimistic about the approach before it has been tested in people. Quote, there have been lots of studies that seem to show ameliorating changes in Alzheimer's mouse models, he says. But the same positive effects are rarely seen with trials are done on humans. Oh, Rocklaz. this is by Michael Marshall. Rocklaz reveal the sun's repeating cycle. The solar cycle during the dinosaur era is similar to that of the day, and its 700 million year old history is hidden in layers of rock. Ooh. Now, dinosaurs is not 700 million years ago. I think it's 500 million years ago for the multicellular organisms and 300 million years ago for surface animals. During the solar maximum, there are many dark sunspots seen at the dark surface and hardly anything during the minima. The maximum and minima alternate on an 11-year cycle, which is consistent over hundreds of years of observations. Now, evidence from geological records says this cycle has a fairly steady for several hundred million years. The team of Donggi Tang and Xiao Shai, the Chinese University of Geosciences in Beijing, has now constructed the solar system's cycles between 810 and 117 million years ago. At this time, life on Earth was still relatively primitive, since there probably weren't any complex animals. stuns me. How can you possibly say that? You definitely weren't. The planet was about almost entirely freeze over for the second time in its history. That's right, the cosmic ice ball. Oh, that's a few hundred million years out. To find out the solar cycles was like, the team studied sedimentary rocks called laminates in South China. These formed at the bottom of the lake. In winter, the river carried silt into the lake and was laid down in a thin layer. In summer, calcite precipitated, forming another layer on top, followed by a layer of algae in autumn. Yeah, you're allowed to have that. And the pattern repeated annually, resulting in many thin layers, with each set of three representing a year. The thickness of the layers and their chemical makeup varied over the 11-year period, just as the sun cycles do today. This probably occurs because the solar cycle can subtly influence the weather. The solar activity is low, more galactic cosmic rays enter the Earth's atmosphere and trigger extra cloud formation. This means more rainfall as the river carries more sediment to the lake at these times. It's sort of strange that this is, well, yeah. It's strange that it's only just one Chinese group have looked at them. This is by Andrew. We're 21 minutes in. The Brain Cells That Can Let You Pee When You Want by Andy Coghlan. If you have ever had to hold on for an hour before being able to go to the toilet, thank your special brain cells of your ability to control when you urinate. Like humans, mice learn to control when they urinate. To attract mates, males intentionally leave urine wherever they smell females. Research shows the ship's research unit Institute at La Jolla, California, and her colleagues have used this ability to identify the brain cells involved in urination, as you would. The team had previously identified neurons in the brainstem region, the part of the brain that extends downwards from the spinal cord. Okay. So your brain actually only really gradually begins in your spinal cord, goes up into the brain stem and goes on. But these alone aren't enough for the mouse to urinate. Muscles that constrict the urethra, the tube that empties the bladder, need to relax too. Analyzing chemicals made by slices of silt from the regions of the brain, Tim identified around 200 neurons that didn't behave the same way as the bladder controlling cells. When the team stimulated these neurons, the mouse that urinated on demand. Measurements made using implanted pressure recorders show that the activation of these neurons relaxes muscles that normally hold the urethra closed. Chemically blocking the neurons stopped the mice from urinating when they were exposed to female scents. Quote, identifying the neurons now opens the door for new ways of understanding and treating incontinence, says Stowers. She thinks the brain cells might have a role in the bodily functions such as defecation, giving birth, orgasm, and ejaculation. Like urination, these depend on relaxation of muscles at the base of our pelvis. The muscles stay contracted your whole life and only relax briefly during a handful of behaviours, urination, defecation, sex, and childbirth, she says. It's interesting, of course, when you have an erection, when you're actually hung. So when you say, he's well hung, it's because he's got an erection. Sterile farmed fish may help protect wild salmon by Michael Lepage. From Norway to Canada, farmed Atlantic salmon are escaping in such large numbers that they are a threat to local salmon. These could be prevented by making farmed fish sterile. But there's a catch. The sterile fish are less nutritious. Salmon farming, or what's genetic engineering, CRISPR, as far as I can see if they, I don't know what they're going to do. Salmon farming has satisfied a soaring demand without the need to catch ever more wild salmon, while it's also created an entirely new threat. Farm salmon have transformed into a domestic animal by selectively breeding. They eat more, grow faster, and have less fear of predators. This means they're less likely to survive in the wild, and so weaken wild salmons when they interbreed with them. Norway is tackling the problem in several ways, from trying to reduce the number of escapees to having snorkelers spear farmed salmon that turn up in rivers before they can interbreed. Gee, Norway. But some experimental farms there are already using the test as the ultimate solution, making the female, the farm salmon sterile. One way to do this is to brutally pressurize fertilized eggs, which makes them retain an extra set of chromosomes, resulting fish tripods have three sets of chromosomes. This method was already used worldwide to sterilize the trout for release in rivers. Now, well, that's interesting. Gee whiz, that's very interesting. So you get an egg, you pressurize it, and it just puts an extra, let's just say, fertilized eggs. I wonder how that works. You pressurize it, and it gets an extra cell. Okay. As confirmed, tripod salmon are also effectively sterile. The females don't develop gonads, while the males didn't produce sperm. Less than 1% of the eggs fertilized survived for the 5-week stage when the experiment stopped. And of course, you'd just stop it there. The method doesn't need to be 100% reliable because little interbreeding doesn't matter. And any disadvantaged gene variant will soon be eliminated by evolution. This is so confused. The problem, because, they all have a gene problem, okay. The problem comes when so many escapees interbreed that they introduce bad genes faster than they can be weeded out. If this is happening year after year after year, there are enough of them, you are swamping the local population, says Kevin Glover of the New Region at the University of Bergen in Norway. A quarter of the wild salmon in Norway have 10% or more DNA from farmed salmon. The problem could be even worse in countries such as Scotland, but no one's checking. Nor do we know just how much the threat is, gene pollution is. Because wild salmon populations are declining in many other regions, such as dams blocking their way to spawning grounds. Quote, we don't have evidence of wild populations collapsing because of interbreeding, said Glover. That does not mean it has not occurred. And triploid farm salmons could eliminate this threat with wild salmon. Maris work reveals another problem. Triploid salmon have a lower fat content and less beneficial omega-3. Now, it's interesting that omega-3 gets out if you don't have, if you treat salmon. There's so many ways that you can treat salmon, you just lose the omega-3. The omega-3 content of farm salmon is already falling because of efforts to make it more sustainable by relying less on wild-caught fish as feed. While the triple fish are doing fine on some experimental fish farms in Norway, says Glover, in others they're not. Unlike triploid trout, triploid salmon appear less resilient. It might be necessary to breed strains of salmon that copes better with triploidly and has a high fat content, which is sort of the solution. This is unusual. I've got a wild pigeon coming up to me. That's, normally they are not that time. They're quite, pigeons are quite scared. No, I don't know what it's doing. Okay. This is wild Australian pigeon, so they've got a... they're obviously a pigeon, but they've got this big mohawk, and their feathers have got tiger stripes on the side of them. They're a bit like a leopard. Not a leopard, a... how to describe it? A zebra. It's pretty amazing. Okay. Others working on ways of making salmon sterile by genetic modification, but won't be easy to get the regulatory approval. Tripoli is a method that is ready right now and can be implemented much more easily, says Murray. Of course, down in Tasmania, there's big salmon farms, but no salmon. Anyway, so if it's wild salmon, it's got to be 100%. Okay, this article is got, again, by Michael Lepage. 2022 climate report. It'll be hot. And we're now at 28 minutes. I've got to reach my expected read allotment. Expect a lot more heat in the coming years. The world will be warm at an even faster rate from 2018 to 22 than the underlying global warming trend, according to forecasting methods so simple it can run on a laptop. We're fairly good at predicting the weather the next few days. Long-term forecasting of climate is also providing it reliable. Now, what's interesting is that the prediction of predictability is very good. They can't predict how, their predictions may be flawed, but they can predict how well they're flawed with amazing accuracy. Yet what would be really useful would be a detailed forecast of months and years ahead. The chaotic nature of weather means it's never possible to predict events like heat waves years in advance. But some aspects of climate, such as the average yearly temperature, are predictable. There are 10 groups worthwhile, including the US, UK Met Office, collaborating in a multi-year forecast based on supercomputer models of the planet and incorporate the laws of physics. In their 2018 to 22 forecast maps suggest the Northern Hemisphere will keep warming especially fast, and that Australia and South Africa could get much less rainfall than North. Blood oath. A few groups are also making forecasts based on much simpler semi-empirical methods. These look at what happened in the past and what's going to, what's happening now, and then brute force statistics to root what happened next. No physics involved. This week, a semi-empirical method unveiled by Florian Savec of the University of Western Brittany in France and Sabine Driftholt of the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute. Its predictions of rapid warming from 2018 to 2022 are broadly in line with those made by the supercomputer models. Thank you. I wonder if they knew in advance. The new method may be useful addition to our toolkit, but it doesn't add much. The paper suggesting the possibility of making predictions on mobile devices. There is no particular need for this, given we have the internet. That's exactly what my next thought was. You know, why do you need it? Because we need it. The study also predicts only the average global surface temperature, which is by far the easiest thing to do with the least useful. The paper claims, quote, the accurate, reliable inter-annual predictions of global temperatures are key for determining regional climate change impacts. That is not the case, says Adam Seppels, the head of the Long Range Prediction UK at the Met Office. Long-term warming trend certainly matters, but the small changes of average global surface temperature from year to year have to be discernible impact on regional weather. For instance, has no discernible impact on regional weather. For instance, 2018 is not as hot as 2016 was in terms of global average, yet there's been some ferocious heat waves. Long-term regional forecasts would be more useful, but the semi-empirical method cannot provide them, says Sercliffe, and although supercomputers models are already making regional forecasts, the Met Office webpage hosting the forecast carries the disclaimer. Decadal predictions are still experimental. The forecast should not be relied on for making decisions, particularly on regional scales. In other words, it's certainly going to be hot, but we have to wait to exactly when. This is a typical New Scientist article where you're reporting things and it's hyped up and you have to read into it. So this is Ivan Yi, the origin of the oldest rocks on Earth revealed, and I'm at 32 minutes. The oldest rocks ever found on our planet may have been born in the asteroid bombardment more than 44 billion years ago. Discovered at Kista River, Canada, about 3 decades ago, the ancient granite or felsic rocks formed about 600 meters after the Earth's creation, before life arose. 600 million years. They contained a distinct mix of elements compared with rocks that come later, suggesting it may have been created by a different geological process. Jim Johnson of Curtin University in Australia and his colleagues simulated the conditions these rocks could have been formed. Jim concluded that partial melting of the Earth's surface at the temperature of 800 to 600 degrees under very low pressure may have contributed to their creation. This would have been impossible for the young Earth to reach such high temperatures unaided, says Johnson. Instead, he thinks that the late heavy bombardment, the period of intense asteroid impact on our planet that left the moon heavily created, may also be responsible. We know the Earth was bombarded 600 to 700 million years after its birth. The fact that there are still only felsic rocks older than 4 billion years that we know the instantly got me thinking about impacts as a possible cause. With such scale, large-scale meteorite showers, rocks like this one found at the Kasta River could have been prevalent at the time, he says. But later plate tectonics would have swallowed most of them up, meaning the rocks could only be the only survivor for the next extraterrestrial impacts that happened early in our planet's history. Johnson now hopes to explore places like Siberia to discover more geological evidence in support of his idea. Okay, well, at least that was an interesting article in terms of churning up old memories for me. And 34 minutes in. Crowdbots that mess up science. Now, that's interesting. By Chris Storkel-Walker. Storkel-Walker. That's a name to remember. Now, I've absolutely forgotten what I had to remember before. There was something I had to remember. Now, I know you're on the... on it, you probably wrote it down. I cannot remember what I had to remember. I have to go back. There's something I had to look up. I'll go back and look at that. An army of bots infiltrated crowdsourcing. Amazon's Mechanical Turk is a crowd working platform that pays people small sums to take part in mental tasks such as taking photos filling out forms. Essentially, it's a way to get humans to perform robot jobs that machines can't yet manage. But now robots are starting to take on the tasks themselves. That is the problem, because the platform is widely used by scientists as a cheap way to carry out research. Hu Bai, a social psychologist at the University of Minnesota, was using it to collect data on perception of far-right movements when he noticed a massive spike in support for the groups including Ku Klux Klan and the Nazi Party. Digging deeper into the data, he discovered a number of responses to open-ended questions within surveys didn't have any connection to the question. Instead, they simply had very, very good or very nice. But I also found that around half of the sample, 578 responders, had the same GPS location as someone else. Around 50 were supposedly logging in from a situation in Buffalo, New York. A handful of others appeared to have taken the survey in the middle of a lake in Kansas. The strange locations are telltale signs that Box had taken the survey, says, but I was wondering what was going on. He was not the only one to have noticed the problem with the data. Robert Bach and John Schofield of Missouri State University and University of Missouri identified bots completing Mechanical Turks around 2% of the time in a separate analysis conducted last year. We already know that gathering scientific data with a Mechanical Turk can be problematic. Previous research indicates that between 14 and 18% of responses to surveys posted on Mechanical Turks are fraudulent in some way. It makes it hard to see what actually happens to your data, says Bokken. Adding bots to the mix will only make things worse. Bai says set up an online survey of fellow researchers to report any anomalies in their data that may be the work of bots. He's received about 20 replies so far. It's sort of like this Russian doll sort of complete way of using the internet. Quite 3 months ago, no more than 5 to 10% of total subjects were based were subject by bots. Now half my participants aren't human. Kurt Gray, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, is editor of a psychology journal where he estimates at least half the papers he reviews include data from Mechanical Turk. Quote, it's worrying you're not observing real people making real decisions, he says. We're in the business of determining how and why people act, and we're not looking for people. We're not doing our jobs. For those who rely on Mechanical Turk to make a living using crowdsourcing bots, it's a natural progression as it becomes harder to learn enough money on these platforms, says Kirsty Midland, who runs the Turko Nation, a forum of workers on the site. Bots do not are not just there to take money from academics. They're a way to level the playing field, she says. They give us control over our hourly rate. They give us control over the income we make. Amazon did respond to this quote. So this is part of the internet world I just do not understand. That's just astounding. So there's Mechanical Turk. It gives out stuff on the internet for you to work. The US Navy wants to fire slime at boats. Kids aren't the only one who loves slime. This is by David Humbling. Kids aren't the only ones who love slime. The US Navy wants to make a gloopy hobby to the next level. Making a super expanding slime that can stop boat propellers turning. Currently, the US Navy stops suspicious boats, such as those suspected smuggled, by firing a plastic rope at the boat's propeller. This tangles the mechanism, which isn't very friendly, and it's hard to disentangle. Synthetic slime could halt small boats by clogging their propellers before later dissolving just away. Justin Jones and his colleagues at the Utah State University have a 15-month Navy contract to experiment making slime proteins with this in mind. James Slime is inspired by the hagfish. I love it. And you're like Chris, and so it's got these slimes. I did something on the hagfish. I'll have to go back. Gee, my memory's really going. I have to go back and remember the thing. It's an eel-like creature that deters predators, projecting a jet of slime that clogs the mouths and gills. When it comes to contact with seawater, the slime swells by a factor of several thousand. One hagfish can produce several litres in one go. Hagfish slime has two components, a sticky mucin thread-like proteins. The proteins threads provide toughness and elasticity to the pattern of repeating proteins similar to spider silk. Jones says his team is using modified E. coli bacterium to produce the proteins, a technique honed in his lab 20 years of research into artificial spider silk. The aim is to move the labour-intensive process that makes just a few grams at a time to an automated system turning out industrial quantities. The team will then work on spinning the proteins into fibres, again using experience of spinning spider silk proteins. It won't be easy. Quote, the devil is in the details, as with the spider silk, says Jones. As well as smugglers, a slime barrier could stop small boats armed with aimed at larger vessels, as the terrorist attack on the USS Cold in 2000. 40 minutes, see how I go. It's important that I actually get it and slap it, and I just am... Okay, I don't think I'll last that much longer. Okay, by Michael Marshall, Supervolcano's Hidden Secrets. A long-dormant supervolcano in California still holds more than 1,000 cubic kilometres of semi-molten magma. Finds suggest that the volcano is not entirely extinct, but a major eruption remains unlikely. Long Valley Caldera, caldera means cauldron, is in eastern California, 32 kilometres across and almost a kilometre deep. It marks the spot where 760,000 years ago a supervolcano spewed out the excess of 1,400 cubic kilometres of materials in just 6 days. Okay, well, I don't know how they know 6 days. The cloud of scorching ash and rocks blanketed the surrounding 50 kilometres. The ash landed as far as Nebraska and almost 20,000 kilometres away. The volcano hasn't erupted on a similar scale since, although small eruptions continued until about 100,000 years ago. Since then, it has been dormant, but since the late 1970s, the dome at the centre of the caldera has been slowly rising. So geologists have been studying the area to find out whether it might erupt again. Ashton Flinders of the U.S. Geological Survey at Menlo Park, California, and his colleague put together data from a seismic station within 150 kilometres of the caldera within the last 26 years and converted it into a three-dimensional image of the rocks and let them... The coherence. This is exactly the same thing. Optical coherence tomography. I'll have a look at that. This let them estimate how much magma was still molten and how much was solidified. They identified the zones in the middle of the crust that seemed to contain more than 1,000 cubic kilometres of magma. 1,000 is not all that much, because you can get that by 10 by 10 by 10. That's right, to get up there. Is that? Yeah, oh no, this will be... 10 by 10 by 10. Is that 1,000? Yeah, that's 1,000 kilometers. Okay. That's a lot of magma. Okay. But Flinders emphasizes just because it doesn't mean it will erupt. That's because the magma will only erupt if a large fraction is molten. Magma is less than 50% melt, typically won't erupt. His team estimates that 25% of the Long Valley magma is molten, making a large scale eruption unlikely. However, it is possible there are small pockets where melt fraction is higher than 27%. The study couldn't pick out such details. If one region achieves a melt fraction of 50% or more, it could lead to a localized semi-sized eruption, but not a supervolcano blast. Quote, I imagine there could be small eruptions and... Indeed, they are most likely, says Robert White of the University of Cambridge. But there hasn't been anything for a very long time. Quote, there seems what we are seeing in Long Valley Caldera is a supervolcano dying slowly. This vast magma reservoir gradually crystallizing into solid rock. If Flinders is right about how much of it is molten, it will take a long time before it's dead, and might have a few ordinary sized eruptions left in it. But the time when it might have unleashed a super eruption is long past. This is in stark contrast to Yellowstone's super volcano in Wyoming, which remains a threat, albeit not one that may not erupt in a big way for thousands of years. A 2015 study found 1,000 cubic kilometres magma chamber underneath Yellowstone, which is only a factor of 3, you know, 30 kilometres by 30 kilometres by 30 kilometres more, because that's 3 by 3 by 3 is I have to get that in my head. Okay, and at 45, I'll see if I can get up to 50 minutes here. It pays to play it cool when online dating by Chelsea White. Hey, short neutral openers, internet dating sites may be a good idea, especially if you're hoping for a response from someone outside your league. Elizabeth Burke and Max Newman at the University of Michigan studied the messaging patterns of 94,478 men and a slight smaller number of women on a free online dating website. Users were located in New York, Boston, Chicago, Seattle, and were all seeking heterosexual relationships with their genders were self-identified. The pair found that women received more messages than men, and most of the messages sent out of the service only go to a small fraction of the users. The most popular person in the study was a 30-year-old woman in New York who received 1,504 messages during the one-month study period. But Birch Newman ranked each user's desirability by the number of initiating messages they received, which they were themselves weighted by the desirability of the person sending them, using the same kind of maths used to rank web pages in Google search. People of both genders generally contacted others who had roughly the same ranking as them, so they were fairly self-aware. But the majority of people, users, both male and female, still messaged some people who were out of their league. On average, these attempts to aim high were targeted at people who were ranked 25% more desirable by that user. When trying their luck with more attractive people, men were more successful in getting a response if they sent less enthusiastic message. I remember thinking, this is a strategy that can't possibly work, says Butch, but it does. In all four cities, men got slightly lower reply rates when they wrote more positively worded messages. The only men in Seattle, saw a payoff from writing a longer message. I have to doubt about the importance of that particular type of research. I'll get this away, and this is episode 1. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.